the true price of things. Sometimes it's quite surprising. My electric bill, which used to be coming from the Long Island Lighting Company, now it comes from another company in New Jersey. When I added up the bill, and they break it down into four or five different charges. In other words, each chunk of kilowatt hours that I burn, the first 600 kilowatt hours I pay this price, the next 10,000 kilowatt hours I pay that price, and so on. When you figure it all out and you add up all the numbers and the percentages and the taxes and whatever, the bottom line for me is a little bit shy of 21 cents per kilowatt hour for electricity on Long Island. That's what I'm paying. And I don't think anybody is paying anything very much different, if you know what I mean. When you finally add up all the individual charges, it's a little bit unfair because I'm adding in the tax and the fuel offset charge and all these other things, but that's what you're paying. So it comes down to around 20 and a half, 21 cents per kilowatt hour. And it would be tempting to start thinking about my my 4-kilowatt motor generator set. At the price of gasoline, and I could be getting 4 kilowatts out of it, would I come out ahead? The answer is no. It's still more expensive to run your motor generator set. It is the second most expensive electricity in the United States. The more expensive electric company is the one that's a private company in Hawaii, which I don't know the exact number, but maybe they're running 23 cents a kilowatt hour. I think there are people in certain portions of the United States that are paying numbers like 5 cents a kilowatt hour. So, on Long Island, electricity ain't cheap. Let me drop. I think a part of that is because we're still paying off the Shoreham Nuclear Power Station, which I think was something close to $8 billion, and we essentially never really got any kilowatts out of it. And so that turned into a bit of a disaster, economically speaking. Already. The next person on the list, as you can tell, we haven't got a complete answer for you, Joe. Know a little more, but we haven't got the answer. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, check that. You got it, Joe.
Okay, very good there, Dick. I have two other quick questions related to this subject. One is does the amount, with oil heat, maybe you know this, maybe you don't, is the amount of BTUs you get at a certain rating, so like I said, my furnace is rated for, say, 151,000 BTUs per hour running a 1.25 gallon per hour nozzle. If you drop the nozzle to, say, like 0.65, which is almost close to half of that, give or take, does the BTU drop in a linear fashion, like about half the amount of BTUs, or is it some other formula that comes into play with that? That's question number one.
Overly coincidental. I am running a 0.6 gallon per hour nozzle. And because I've read the article on nozzles, if you simply Google the word oil nozzle, and I can't think of the name of the main company, they have a beautiful, I guess it's a 30-page data sheet you can download. It's in color. And when you start reading all that information as to how to make nozzles efficient, you'll find out that if you reset the pump that is forcing oil into your nozzle, and almost all of them start off at 100 pounds per cubic inch, and you set it to, you turn the knob, and you got the right kind of a gauge on there, so you set it at 150, you get a much finer atomization, a much more complete burn. However, it is a nearly linear relationship. Joe, as far as the flame itself is concerned, let me think. Let me run that by again. Assuming your nozzle is doing its job and it's finally atomizing those oil droplets into as small as little droplets it possibly can, and you're mixing that with air with the right air-fuel ratio, and you're completely burning that oil, then however number of BTU you get when you're running 1.2 gallons, when you go down to 0.6 gallons, half of that, you will get exactly half that number of BTUs out of that flame. Now, depending on how your furnace is operating, is all the heat of that flame being coupled into the boiler? In my case, even the portion that gets missing the boiler, in my case, goes out the flue pipe, and the flue pipe is so nice and long, it heats the house, and therefore the actual flue gas is going up my chimney. I've got to stick a thermometer in there someday and find out exactly what temperature it is. I'd like to believe it's a nice low temperature that I've almost sucked out all the heat, if you know what I mean, of those flue gases. So, everything I read, Joe, leads me to believe that when you go to a smaller nozzle with the right fuel-air ratio, and if you use the right kind of nozzle as far as the flare angle and whether it's hollow or solid, when you choose the right nozzle that's appropriate for the geometry of your furnace, and you're using a smaller nozzle, if you do it right, the possibility exists you get slightly higher efficiency than linear. In other words, by cutting back the number of gallons per hour with your nozzle by a 2-to-1 ratio, you think you're going to get half the number of BTUs. You may get 6/10 of the number of BTUs really being coupled to your house when you put it all together, when you do it right, when you read that article. So if you like, I'll find the name of that company that sells this beautiful, that's not sales, it's free of charge, that can get you this downloadable data sheet.
Repeater, time out.
This downloadable data sheet on nozzles. If you have any trouble finding it, I'll get you that name and tell you how to get to that website. It's very good reading, Joe. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, the tech man.
Okay, very good. And the second one was, not really a question, but it's sort of like a comment. Well, I'll just tell you what it did. And he was speaking about temperatures in the on the flue pipe. I have an 1,800 degree Fahrenheit thermocouple made by Fluke, so it goes up that high. That's what it's supposed to be rated for. And I did look at that the other day. I took the wire and put it about halfway in the center of the flue pipe. And with the inspection, like the this is just the top cop cover, not the inspection cover that you use for cleaning the oil burner, but just the top, like the visual cover. And then let me get to this. And I noticed that I got a temperature of somewhere around 600, 610 degrees, 620 degrees. And I did notice this. If you adjust the flame by adjusting the air-to-fuel ratio or adjusting the amount of air it gets, you can pull the air back and make the flame to be almost a bluish color type of flame or a yellowish-bluish color type of flame. And that led to the hottest temperature going out the flue. So, and I guess it's the path of the flame is going up through the heating, I guess the water jack pretty close to inside the oil burner. I guess it's making it hotter. And I also noticed that if you put the air the other way, so the flame completely fills the firebox, or more than fills the firebox, it becomes very yellowish in color. The temperature went down almost 100 degrees. Back to you, Dick.
And good common sense would lead you to believe that the temperature going down 100 degrees is a cooler flame because you're adding more air to it. You're getting more complete combustion. You're not making soot. And the lower temperature of the flame sounds inefficient. However, in my case, that just means that the amount of heat that gets coupled from the flame to my heat exchanger, call it boiler, is a little bit less. But in my case, more of the heat gets extracted downrange as the flue goes out that very long flue pipe. So I'm still getting the same amount of heat, in my opinion. And there's a trade-off here. When you're getting fine enough atomization, you're getting complete combustion, and you're putting in enough air, and you're not making soot, two or three things happen that's good, and one thing that happens is bad. The thing that happens bad is the flame is a little bit cooler. The good thing that happens is you're not making soot. The soot itself couples itself, it connects itself to the boiler, and it acts like an extremely good insulator, so that now the heat flow between flame and boiler gets decreased because of the soot. When you study what's really going on with your nozzle, the droplet size of the nozzle really is a Gaussian distribution. Can we drop it? Some of those droplets are very large, that's the left-hand side of the chart, so to speak. Some of the droplets are very small, that's the right-hand side of the chart, where the horizontal axis is droplet size and the vertical axis is probability. And somewhere in the middle is the average droplet size. And now you can put another vertical line on that chart, which is the amount of air you're putting in. If you're putting in too little air, then only the fine droplets are being burned and the large droplets are not being fully oxidized and they're making soot. You put in enough air so that all the droplets are being large and small are being completely burned. You're now getting a cleaner flame. You're making less soot. But now because you're putting in air, you're getting some cooling from that air and therefore the flame temperature is lower. I like to favor the extra air side. I favor the side of lower soot generation, lower carbon monoxide generation, because everybody's chimney leaks a little bit, particularly on an older house, and a small amount of those gases going up the chimney in some cases end up in your house. And if you're getting a more complete combustion because you've used a richer air to fuel ratio, a more complete burn, you're making a much smaller ratio of carbon monoxide and maybe none at all, and you're making a much smaller amount of soot. So I favor rich air, lean fuel, the yellow flame as you call it, and I know I'm losing a little bit of efficiency because I'm doing some cooling there, but if I really worried about that cooling, let me think now. It is the hot air from my house that's going into the furnace. There are some people who go the next step where they create a completely separate, let me drop this. KBCI Austin Info. Okay, that person said it so fast, I heard the word info. I'll go back to you in a minute and get your call letters. There are people who will put a completely separate piece of ductwork from the outside air going into the furnace, and they insulate it so that the coldness of that ductwork doesn't cool off the air in the house, so that they're burning outside air as opposed to inside air that has already been heated, and they get a little bit more efficiency out of that. The disadvantage of that, though, is between a hot day and a cold day, they're getting different temperature of air going into the flame, and therefore they're probably getting a slightly different air-fuel ratio because of that phenomenon. The person with the additional information, please give us your call letters and your name, and then proceed with your information. K2LIW in the TechNet, my name is Dick.
K2RW, this is KB2MAR. Name here is Gabe, and I have information regarding the nozzle information that you want to give out to the TechNet. The company is Delvan. They're the people who make those high-quality nozzles, and they have that article you're talking about. Back to that.
Well done, Gabe. Now I recognize the name, Delvan. D-E-L-V-A-N, I think it is. Or was it D-E-L-E? Tell me the exact spelling on that one, Gabe.
D-E-L-V-A-N.
Okay, so the logical, simple spelling. Yeah, you Googled the word Delvan and oil nozzle, and you've got a very nice, I don't know the exact number, 15, 25-page article. Download it, take your own sweet time reading it, and you will, as a result of reading that, in many cases go down to a smaller number of gallons per hour. You will go up to 150 pounds per cubic inch. When you're at Sid Harvey, you can buy a very nice pressure gauge. Your oil pump on your oil-fired furnace has a number of these approximately quarter-inch diameter plugs in it. And you unscrew the right one of those tapered plugs and screw in this oil pressure gauge. And now you can, if you want to, continuously monitor the pressure of the oil going into your nozzle. And now you turn the right screw on that oil pump mechanism, and you go up to 150 pounds per square inch, and maybe lower the number of gallons per hour of the rating of the nozzle, because when you put 150 pounds per square inch into a 0.6 gallon per hour nozzle, you probably get 0.65. It's not a linear relationship because of the so-called Bernoulli principle, it's the Reynolds number principle. You get a slight increase in the number of gallons per hour that flows through it at the higher pressure. Let me drop the call. But that's not a linear relationship. But the higher pressure does give you a hell of a lot better atomization, and you'll see some beautiful pictures in that Delvan article. Another thing while you're at Sid Harvey you might want to consider buying is another fuel filter. I am running a cascaded fuel filter. I seem to be the only person on Long Island I know that's doing it. You can buy at Sid Harvey a very fine density white foam kind of filter that will fit into your filter container. However, does a beautiful job of getting rid of the fine grit that's going to be eroding your nozzle. And you should be changing the nozzle once every year because it does experience some wear. There's always some fine grit. But with the right kind of a filter, you can get rid of the fine grit. That's the good news. However, unless you've got the cleanest oil on planet Earth, you'll be clogging that filter in 2 weeks, if you know what I mean. So the coarse kind of filter is the first filter I've got, and the fine filter is the second filter. So I've got two cascaded filters. As such, I only have to change the filters close to once per year, and I get a whole lot of yucky sludge in that great big coarse filter, the filter. And the fine filter has a little bit of sludge in it, and the fine the grit that it has removed. And if you're smart enough to buy the replacement bolt for the second filter, the fine filter, you buy the bolt that holds that filter container together. It comes with a vacuum gauge in the top of the bolt. And now you can read the inches of vacuum that your oil pump, let me drop. You can read the inches of vacuum that your oil pump is pulling as it pulls oil out of the pipe going to your tank and through those filters. So now that if the pickup nozzle in the tank starts clogging, if the pipe to the tank starts clogging, if the filters start clogging, in any one of those cases, the vacuum gauge on the last filter container starts climbing. When it climbs up to about 5 or 10 inches of water, you can go to 30 inches, I think, is complete hard vacuum. When you get to 5 or 10 inches of water vacuum on that gauge, you know you've got a clog somewhere. When I start seeing that happening, I change the filters, and 99% of the time, the problem goes away. Once in a while, the sludge built up in the oil line is also something that's going to be blown out, and there's two solutions to that. While you're at Sid Harvey, you can buy this blue fluid, I call it. Unfortunately, it's getting a little bit pricey. I think it's now $16 for a little bottle of it that's good for 250 gallons of oil. You pour it into the tank first before the oil delivery, therefore it gets nicely mixed. The stuff used to be called Sludge Buster. It's got another name now, oil conditioner or something like that. It dissolves sludge, it dissolves water, and it'll keep your system nice and clean. And if you don't use that, oh, by the time you've gotten about 10 or 12 oil deliveries, you probably have built up enough sludge that the pipe will become clogged, and you can buy a so-called CO2 gun, where you install that onto the pipe that leads from the oil tank to your furnace, and right before the first filter assembly, you open up that particular flare nut fitting, you connect a so-called CO2 gun, let me drop it. You put a cartridge in it, and it blows the oil back into your tank at high velocity, and you'll hear some bubbling coming out of the tank, if you know what I mean, when you do this, and it clears out any clog that you've got in that pipe or that pickup tube. Well, that blowout gun, I used to use it once every 2 or 3 years. I needed to because the pipe or the pickup became clogged with sludge. Now that I use this conditioner fluid, that doesn't happen anymore. So it's a very nice way of keeping the system free flowing, if you know what I mean. So at Sid Harvey, I recommend the oil conditioner, the cascaded set of filters, the fine filter, and the higher pressure on the nozzles. You put that all together with the right fuel-air mixture, you can make a very quiet, clean-burning furnace that when you use the smaller nozzle, you're going to run a larger number of hours per day, which you at first would think is bad. It's good. Your furnace tends to run more efficiently when it's running a smaller number of BTUs for a greater number of hours. The slight disadvantage, let me drop. The slight disadvantage of running a smaller nozzle is that this day that we're going to get at the end of this week, where it's going to go down to -5 degrees, the possibility exists that with my 0.6 gallon per hour nozzle, where I'm getting a smaller number of BTUs out of my furnace, the possibility exists that on that maximum cold day that happens once per 5 years, maybe my house running full blast is only going to get up to 67 degrees, if you know what I mean. It won't get up to the 72 degrees that my family likes to keep it at. And so my family is tough enough that you wear a ski jacket during that episode, and I still think it's a good trade-off. But that's what works for me. Not everybody's going to agree with this. Anybody with further questions or comments on auto burners and how to set them, give me a call that is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. I know that we amateurs can definitely maintain this if we so desire to do so.
KD2 HUC. To CMS.
Okay. KD2ZTU, I think it is. ZUC, something like that. And then CMS. ZUC first, go right ahead and correct me on your call letters.
Yeah, the call letters are KD2HUC. That's Kilo Delta 2, Hotel Uniform Charlie. The name is Steve. Dick, one of the things that I found made a huge difference, and it actually saved me probably 25% to 30% on the oil, was to upgrade the Aquastat using, they have the outdoor reset systems. They used to be, you know, very big in commercial, and now they make them for residential boilers. Beckett makes a nice one. And basically what it does is it adjusts the boiler temperature based upon the outdoor ambient, because, you know, like you said, you know, when it's 0 degrees out, you need, you know, your boiler running at 200 degrees and you need the maximum output. When it goes to 50 degrees, you might be able to get away running the boiler at 140. So this runs an algorithm and it automatically makes, you know, constantly adjusts the boiler temperature based upon the outside needs. Saved me a lot of money thus far.
So once again, Steve, what was the number of degrees Fahrenheit your Aquastat was set at before, and what's the number of degrees it's set at now for your particular system? Go ahead, Steve.
Well, when they did my house, you know, they used 0 degrees, you know, for the outside when they did the heat counts, and they came up with a 200-degree boiler setting, which is also used for, you know, I have an indirect hot water tank. And now, it's the actual limit is dynamic. The level changes based upon the outside ambient temperature. So, you know, when it's 15 degrees outside, the boiler goes up to 200. When it's 50 degrees out, it stops it short based upon its algorithm, you know, somewhere around 150. You know, if it's 60 degrees out, it might only go up to 140. Oil boilers, you can't really run below 140 because the products of combustion condense on the boiler and, you know, damage the boiler. So they don't recommend running oil below 140, at least peerless, which is what I have, doesn't. So, but it's made a huge difference thus far. Back to you, Dick.
That sounds like it makes a lot of sense, Steve. What is the name of the product that does this automatic dynamic setting? And if I modify my Aquastat to go from the dumb Aquastat I used to have, if I had a hot water system, I've got a hot air system, warm air system, so I don't have an Aquastat per se. Oh, yes, I do. Well, that's another cold question. But what I'm getting at is if I go from a dumb Aquastat to this dynamic setting one, roughly how many dollars am I investing, and what brand name is that? Over to you, Steve.
The actual technical term for it is called outdoor reset, and it's made by, you know, the systems are made by various vendors. The one that I have is actually made by Beckett. It's called AquaSmart, and it has you get it with the available outdoor sensor. It'll run one of two ways. It has internal algorithms to try and, you know, maximize heat, but then the outdoor reset feature with the sensor, which is wireless, very convenient, is an additional, you know, accessory. I want to say it probably cost about $300. It's, you know, if you can put together a ham station, you can figure out how to wire it. You know, it's you know, relatively one-day installation and programming. And like I said, it's about $350. And thus far, it saved me about 25%. I installed it a year ago this past Christmas. Back to you, Dick.
Steve, that's a good thing to know about, and I think we got to consider that. Steve, how did you find out about that device? Ooh, did you see an ad somewhere? Did somebody tell you about it? What was the method by which you found out that this AquaSmart, Beckett's a very good brand name, by the way. How did you find out that Beckett made such a product?
I'm an electrician, and I've done numerous boiler controls. I've come across outdoor resets on commercial boilers, and I asked actually a friend of mine, you know, do they make them for residential, and he gave me a couple, and I just, you know, did a search on the web, and lo and behold, there was one made by Beckett, and it works real nice. I agree with you, I happen to like Beckett a lot, and so it's definitely worth the investment, at least I found. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, so now for a hot water fired system, I can see how AquaSmart does a good thing. In the case of a warm air oil fired system, in other words, I've got warm air ducts, hot air ducts, so to speak, I do have the equivalent of a AquaStat. In other words, there is a temperature sensing device that tells the blower when to turn on. Now, in my case, I don't think that's worth changing. When my heat exchanger comes up to a certain temperature, it's time to turn on the blower. If it's turned on before then, it's just circulating the air unnecessarily. Although that's not necessarily bad. There's one other product that you guys should definitely consider buying and adding, and it's nowhere near that expensive. I think what I'm now describing to you is about a $20 product. Let me drop it. It's what I call a differential oil switch. In other words, for about $20, and I think it's a Beckett brand name product, you add this valve. It's an electrically operated valve that goes in the high pressure line in between the pump and the nozzle. And when the furnace turns on, that valve is in the closed mode. It waits for about 3 or 4 seconds until your pump comes up to full pressure and the squirrel cage blower comes up to full speed, and then it suddenly switches open and lets the oil flow through to the nozzle. When the furnace turns off, the valve turns off immediately, stops the oil flow, and that's extremely desirable because under normal circumstances, as your furnace gets turned off, the motor and the squirrel cage blower slowly slow down. You're now decreasing the amount of air you put into the nozzle. The pressure going to the nozzle is going down. Oil is dribbling out of the end of the nozzle, and therefore the end of that burn is a very sooty burn, which is now piling up a whole bunch of ooky black stuff at the end of your nozzle, at the end of the so-called blast tube. And pretty soon that whole system becomes reasonably clogged. By putting in this very simple oil delay switch that I'm discussing, that's about $20, all that very desirable timing, let me drop this. All that very desirable timing takes place where the oil doesn't flow through until everything is up to speed and pressure, and then when the furnace turns off, everything, the oil flow to the nozzle stops immediately, and you're not getting the dribble at the end. And so a hell of a lot of furnaces on Long Island do not have that switch. Since you're in the business, Steve, tell me what percentage of the furnaces do you think have that oil switch? What percentage of them do you think need it? KD2 HUC, K2LAW in the TechNet.
I'll tell you the truth, Dick. I couldn't really answer how many have it and how many don't. I do know that all the Beckett's that I've installed, the AFG and AFG2s, they come with that solenoid right from the factory. It's an integral part of the pump. And the Honeywell controller that comes standard, you know, handles the timing, and it actually has, you know, the built-in output to control it. So all the boilers that I've worked on thus far with these new Beckett's have it. And I know the Riello burners, they've had it for years. I think they actually pioneered that control. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, that's very encouraging information, Steve. So at least the newer pieces of hardware that are being installed over the last few years of those two brand names, Beckett and Riello, have it. I suspect there's a lot of older furnaces on Long Island that do not have it. I know that mine didn't. And before I added it, I know that whenever I did service, I had to clean out the end of the nozzle and the blast tube because of the buildup of the sludge, because of the dribble of oil at the end of the burn. Mr. CMS, I didn't get your prefix, sir. Mr. Charlie Mike Sierra, go right ahead with your name and your full set of call letters and your information or question, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Okay, it's Whiskey Bravo 2, Charlie Mike Foxtrot. The name is Pat Papa Alpha Tango. Just have a few comments. I'll agree with you about the higher fuel pump pressure. The standard fuel pump pressure was 100 pounds, 100 psi. Most nozzles, all nozzles that I know of, are rated that way. A 1 gallon per hour nozzle is 1 gallon per hour with a fuel pump pressure of 100 psi. All the new modern burners that are out now have really upped it to 140 psi. That's now the new standard, 140. The only problem with that is that the nozzles are still standard. So in order to burn the same 1 gallon per hour at 140 psi, it's 0.85. And there's tables where you can do the conversion very easily. So that one I will agree with. Let me let it drop. The second comment I want to make was with regards to, I think he said he was burning 1.25 gallons per hour. He wanted to derate the nozzle down to 0.65. And I may have that incorrect, but just a simple comment, you know, the science behind oil burners is that they're very dependent upon the size of the combustion chamber. The combustion chamber works in tandem with the flame. And the typical flame, when it's running really efficient, is about 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. And the flame is highly dependent upon the reflection of heat from the combustion chamber itself. And there's a range. For instance, a typical would be 0.9 to 1.25, or 0.75 to 1.1. You really can't, or you don't really want to go outside those ranges. For instance, at 1.25, if you go 1.4, the flame is hitting the wall, and that's not good. If you go too low, the flame burns too cold and smoky. So you really want to keep it within no more than 15% variation of that. And if you really want to invest in something to really adjust it yourself, it's very hard to do it by eye. I know I've tried it, and I don't come close. The old-timers, they could look at the flame and really get it spot on. Me, I can't do that. I need instrumentation for that. As an engineer, I want instrumentation. If you can only afford one thing, I would recommend a smoke tester. Go into Blackman, get a back rack. I don't know how to spell that, but back rack. Get a smoke tester and measure the smoke coming out of the flue pipe. And you're striving for zero smoke, no more than a level one. They rate it from 0 to 5, 5 being the worst and illegal. Anything below is a 1 is good, and you'll hardly ever set up. And that's what I would recommend. With that, I don't want to take too much time. Back to that.
Very good, Pat. Lots of good information in there. So Blackman sells that smoke tester. Backrack, I think he said, is the brand name on it. When you read the article from Delrin on nozzles, Delvan, they lead you to believe that the firebox has a certain geometry and the flame is intended to, in other words, the nozzle is intended to give you the right flare angle, solid versus cone or whatever, such that you fill the firebox to a certain percentage without the flame hitting the horizontal walls, but yet still hitting the boiler, I guess, is the way you get the best heat transfer. So the way the flame should fill the firebox should allow you to select the right degrees of flare angle and the right kind of nozzle. I still think that if you go down to a smaller number of gallons per hour and you adjust the air accordingly so that now you are getting complete combustion of that oil, I'd like to believe in the middle of that flame you're going to achieve the desirable temperature that you said is around 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. So as I see it, temperature of flame is somewhat a function of complete atomization of the oil with the right fuel-air mixture. And let me drop. Just because I'm burning a great big flame for an industrial burner at 2 gallons per hour, And if I didn't have the right amount of atomization and the right amount of fuel oil mixture, air fuel mixture, I could easily have a big flame that's running at a cold temperature and making a whole lot of soot. So size of flame and temperature of flame might not be a linear relationship, but proper atomization and the right fuel air ratio, I think, is going to give you the right temperature of flame. So I am guessing, and here you can correct me, that if I go from 1.2 gallons per hour is what I think Joe said he was running, down to 0.65 gallons per hour, and if he's doing a good job of running 140 pounds per square inch, getting good atomization and the right fuel air mixture, although the flame will be a smaller flame, I think he can adjust the geometry of that flame to have the right characteristics compared to his fire chamber. Let me drop this. And I think the center of that flame will achieve the 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit. I wonder if you think that is possible, Pat. CMF, K2LAW, the TechNet.
Okay, WB2 CMF. Now, a lot depends on, when he said he was burning 1.25, was that 1.25 at a pump pressure of 100? If you're going to raise it up to 140 psi and then dropping it to 0.65, then that doesn't necessarily sound like as big a drop as I first thought, from 1.25 to 0.65. But if I just keep it at that level, all things being equal, 100 psi pump pressure, you go from 1.25 down to 0.65, you'll never get to burn properly without making changes to the combustion chamber itself. So that's problematic, in my opinion. I also agree with the well delay valve. I would never install a burner without one now, for all the reasons that you said and a lot, is when it turns off. With an oil delay valve, that flame turns off immediately, no after trip. But more important, there's no soot from all that unburned fuel. So definitely recommended on that.
Very fine, Pat. Sorry about the Whiskey Delta to Charlie Mike Foxtrot. Yeah, I think I find Whiskey Bravo 2. Here we go. I'm entering. Get you right, Pat. Thank you for the information. I knew some of the hams out there were into oil burner technology. Uncle Willie, W2UWC, who used to live in Hempstead, who's now a Silent Key, gave me a lot of the information that I was operating on way back in the early 70s. Good subject, but we amateurs like maintaining our equipment, whether it be our transmitters, our oil burners, certain functions of our automobiles, and so on. We take pride in being able to fix things. So although it's a little bit left of center of normal ham radio questions, from time to time we discuss oil burners because there's two or three different ways you've got to keep the family happy. Let me drop it. In some cases, you need some information about plumbing, because if the fluids do not, if water does not flow into the house and the fluids flow out of the house properly, somebody's going to be unhappy. Electricity has to come into the house and go to the right places. The ham radio equipment has got to work correctly. The car's got to work correctly. The heat has to, and the house has to work correctly. The refrigerator's got to work correctly. I mean, there's a whole set of priorities. I think water flowing out of the house is one of the highest priority. Electricity and heat is one of the next highest priorities. Make sure you're not freezing your food spoiling the food in the summer and the pipes freezing in the wintertime. So we amateurs maintain a lot of this equipment. Quite a few of us do.
Bullshit.
You have an opinion on maintaining equipment, Wes, into XJN, K2LAW?
One more quick comment, please.
Since the night is not that busy, all such as another subject that would be related to home, as we worry about our houses, if you don't mind.
Get Matt out there too, Dick.
Oh, I forgot about Matt. Sorry about that. We got to go to Matt. KC2YDG, Matt, go right ahead. Sorry we kept you so late, waiting. You were a late sign-in and you weren't in my normal portion of the list. You got it, Matt.
Okay, very good, KC2YDT, portable. I recently got a new rig, 82991. It has a whole bunch of filters on there. You know, contour, knot, et cetera. And also the parametric mic EQ. My question was, to keep the HF as noise-free as possible with still hearing the station, what would you guys recommend keeping the notch level set at?
Okay, I heard you ask a question about the notch level setting. K-N-O-T-S is what it sounds like. I'm missing a word here, Matt. Spell it out for me, what you're really asking. Go ahead.
Hey, stand by 1 second. I'm just turning on the bass, so I'll be able to get it. Okay, KC2YDT. I'm looking at the rig right now. It has a N-O, that's November, Oscar, Tango, Charlie, Hotel, setting.
Okay, no way. A notch filter, if I understand you correctly. Many of the rigs that have a digital signal processor, and a few of them that have analog filters, have a notch filter. And my understanding of the reason for the notch filter on an HF rig is to get rid of a heterodyne. If somebody is giving you a key down test in the middle of the frequency that you're using for trying to talk to that DX station, and you're hearing this continuous tone in the background, and if the tone is, let me pick a number, 1.3 kilohertz, and if you adjust your notch filter at 1.3 kilohertz, that annoying tone disappears. If your notch filter is sharp enough, the rest of the audio comes roaring through and you won't even know the notch is there. So my understanding of the usual reason for a notch filter is to eliminate a continuous tone heterodyne that you're getting in the passband of the signal you're trying to listen to. Back to you on that one, Matt. That's my understanding. KC2YDT, T2LIW, and TechNet.
Okay, so now I know we feel the contour portion, to keep the noise level down, the HF, noise, the S1, S2 down, I keep it at 1,000 watts. Now, the notch is only, there's another station coming on, and I hear them in the background to get that clear, correct?
Okay, the question you're asking right now, I think, comes close to the question that National Aeronautics and Space Administration tried solving on the Mercury and Gemini program, and eventually they used some of it on Apollo 2. What they concluded was that no matter what your communication system is, whether it's HF, FM, or whatever, unless the signal is a gangbuster signal, you're going to be hearing some radio noise in the background, whether it be the noise from the front end of your own receiver, whether it be atmospheric noise, whether it be QR Mary, QR Nancy, or whatever. And if you want the highest possible intelligibility, let me drop it. You study the human speech, and you come to the conclusion that somewhere around 600 hertz to somewhere around 2.5 kilohertz is the frequency region where most of the notes coming out of a human voice, giving you intelligibility, allowing you to hear the S's and the T's and the vowels and whatever. And all other audio below and above those frequencies, you chop it off as fast as you can because it represents radio noise that does not contribute to intelligibility. So depending on what is the signal-to-noise ratio, there is an ideal setting for the bandpass filtering, bandwidth, yes, but when it comes to the shape of the total audio bandpass,
skirt select.
Say again?
Skirt selectivity.
Skirt is some of it, but the overall shape There's a name for the overall shape of the setting of all of those frequencies. Now, if you've got a adjuster, what the hell is the name?
Envelope.
Say again?
Envelope.
Envelope comes close. There's a name for the adjusting network that allows you to decide to peak or attenuate 50 hertz, 75 hertz, 100 hertz, 200 hertz, and so on. What was that again?
You're describing a parametric filter. Most JSAPs have one knob for what frequency the notch is at and another knob for the depth.
The overall circuit that allows you to adjust the individual portions of the audio passband. What's the name of that circuit?
Equalizer.
Equalizer. Okay. The way you adjust your audio equalizer. If you've got a gangbuster signal, you'd like to hear everything from DC to light. You'd like to hear the lowest notes and the highest notes of the guy. You hear some nice round audio. He sounds like he's in the room with you. If you've got a gangbuster signal, that's the most pleasant way to listen to the voice. As the signal you're listening to gets weaker and weaker, and the radio noise of various kinds starts coming in, and you want maximum intelligibility, then you have to readjust that equalizer, so to speak, so that only the critical portions of human speech are coming through and everything else is attenuated. And that you, under those conditions, although it's not a pleasant voice to listen to, it sounds, let me drop. It sounds like a very mechanical voice, almost like it's done by a robot, if you know what I mean. But when you adjust the audio that way, under a noisy condition, you get the best intelligibility. So, as I see it, there is an ideal setting of the equalizer audio network depending on what is the signal-to-noise ratio of your particular environment at this particular time. And if you happen to have a particular set of one or two tones in there because somebody is going key down and testing his transmitter and adjusting his PI output network on the air and disturbing everybody else, also throwing in a notch filter to eliminate those particular tones can give you a significant improvement in intelligibility. So, as I see it, Matt, there isn't any one setting. There's various settings of that equalizer, if you've got it, in order to get the most pleasant sounding audio with the greatest amount of intelligibility. When you start adjusting for greatest amount of intelligibility, let me drop. There are guys who want to really get through in contest operations, and they buy themselves an extremely narrow single sideband filter that goes out to about 1.2 kilohertz. It's got a very muffled sounding audio to it, in my mind. Yeah, it's got high intelligibility, but if you use that filter on a strong signal day and you're having a rag chew with that guy, you suddenly realize there's a lot of mental fatigue that takes place because all the missing high frequency notes, your brain had to plug them back in, and you suddenly realize you're doing a hell of a lot of extra mental work to have a rag chew with that particular guy. When you're having a rag chew, I'd like to have the equalizer set for a nice wide bandwidth so the guy sounds like he's in the room with me, but that's only useful if I'm getting a high signal to noise ratio. That's a bunch of opinions on the opinion on that subject, Matt. Let me pass it back to you. Spank your feet a little bit in case we got other people who have got other opinions they want to express. KC2YDT with a little delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's the opinion of a guy from the old era.
Okay. Now, here's a man who works in the audio business as an occupation. In other words, your broadcast transmitters, by definition, must be producing high fidelity audio at all times. So give us the right word on the right way to set equalizers depending on the conditions, Eric. KE2EJ, our broadcast engineer. K2RIW in the TechNet. K2RIW,
KE2EJ. Well, first of all, if we're doing FM radio, that's one thing. But today's world, like digital television, digital, it's a whole different game. But today's modern HF radios have these little things called digital signal processors in them. And in your first example, as you're listening to, you're having a rag chew with someone, and there's an AM carrier, but there's somebody else tuning up right nearby, and they're making a note of about 800 hertz. You flip a little switch, and it puts in something called a least mean square algorithm. And the sort of tracking, so if the guy actually turns his repo,
natural follow. What it'll do is it'll eliminate the cone, leave everything else. The filters in today's HF radios are interesting, especially once you get to software-defined radios, because your filters are really they're just coefficients. You're doing a finite infinite response filter. Yes, the best thing that you could do is have a nice wide bandwidth. You can hear all the harmonic resonance of the sibilant sounds of speech matter, which I hear, but it improves the intelligibility and make it very comfortable to listen. But if you were listening the way my ears filter things, you'd find it very uncomfortable, but eventually your mind kind of like fills in the gap. Let me hear that drop. So with the modern HF transceivers, you now have the ability to, actually some of the good ones have green knobs. You've got the center of the bandpass, which is really, the true name for it in the audio world is the parametric equalizer. Most people are familiar with equalizers that look like a long string of pods that you can actually kind of draw the shape of the bandpass, and each one is like, 50 hertz, the next one may be 70, 60 hertz, the next one may be 80 hertz, the next one may be 100 hertz, and then it starts to space out, and it goes to 1K, 1.5K, 2K, 4K, 8K up the line. With a parametric type of equalizer, you have a knob which you can sweep frequency-wise from the bottom of the bandpass, which might be 30 hertz all the way up to 10 kilohertz. We're talking audio console, but if we're talking radio, it may go up to 3 kilohertz in there, and then we have another knob which controls the bandwidth, how much bandpass we're going to allow the audio to pass through, and then we'll have another knob which will either in a case of the audio, it can either act as an attenuator or act as a gain boost. So you've got a gain control, a width control, and a frequency control. And with that, you can adjust to any given situation in terms of what's going on in radio land and make it so that you can actually get communication intelligibility out of it. K2RIW, K2EJL, and by the way, specifically what kind of a bandpass really depends on the conditions. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, that is pretty much my understanding of what NASA selected. A dynamically adjustable audio, particular shape of the equalization as a function of what was the signal-to-noise ratio for that particular period of time. And there were times when they were getting bursts of noise coming from the metal plates of the 240-foot dish out at Goldstone, California. The metal plates of the parabolic reflector were rubbing against each other and making radio static because they were transmitting and receiving from the same dish simultaneously with a certain number of hundreds of megacycles of separation. But still, some of the transmitter noise was getting into the receiver because of the rusty nail effect of those metal plates rubbing against each other. As the dish was being moved by wind and gravity and whatever, on a windy day, you get all kinds of bursts of noise. Let me drop. And they had to adjust the equalizer accordingly in order to get the maximum intelligibility and the hell with the high fidelity sound of the astronauts, if you know what I mean. The speech intelligibility was most important because when you're out there at, let me say, a lunar distance, the only connection you have with humanity is that radio beam. If something goes wrong with that radio system and you lose that uplink and that downlink of radio communication, you'd like to believe the astronauts could get up to the window of the satellite and you do hand signals, and you look at those hand signals by aiming the Mount Palomar optical telescope, the 200-inch optical telescope, at them on a clear day. You know, Don, well, that the Murphy's Law dictates it's going to be a cloudy day when that occurs. However, you go through the calculation of Mount Palomar looking at a spacecraft at a lunar distance, and the answer is if you had an extremely clear atmosphere, you could barely resolve something that was 100 feet long, tip to tail. You could barely tell the shape of the object if it's 100 feet long. And if you think you're going to look at the window that the astronaut is sitting in front of and he's giving you hand signals and you're going to communicate with him, no way, Jose. The laws of physics won't let you do that. you're at the end of your rope, and you're highly dependent on that radio beam when you're out there at a radio at a lunar distance. And it's a little bit better when you're in low Earth orbit, but not a hell of a lot better. Let me drop. In low Earth orbit, the problem is now the opposite problem. Yeah, you're close enough that you have the resolving power of the Mount Palomar telescope, but now, can you focus the Mount Palomar telescope that close? And because when you're in low Earth orbit, even if the particular orbit swept directly overhead, horizon to horizon at your location, you go from horizon to horizon in something like 18 minutes, and in the middle of that pass, the number of degrees per second that you've got to move that telescope in order to track that satellite is so fast, I don't think you'd be able to do it. You wouldn't be able to keep Mount Palomar aimed at the satellite as it goes whizzing by over your head, if you know what I mean. So, as you can tell, you gotta make sure that radio beam works, because that's the only contact you have with the rest of humanity. KC2YDT, I know we got a little bit off what you're asking, but I think some of it will be helpful to you, Matt. KC2YDT, K2LEW, the Tech Man.
Yeah, QSL, this new rig that I got, it has, all those frequencies that I was just talking about, and it has the parametric EQ, it has all the receive filters, et cetera, et cetera. So, mainly, I think it's more, it's got to get used to, and like you guys said, depending on the band conditions. There's really no one set thing that's usually the best.
I wonder how fat is the owner's manual on that new 991 Yaesu rig of yours? Do they give you lots of words of explanation on this, what's the word for it now? Digital signal processing audio system or computer controlled network? Do they give you lots of information? And is it written in easily understood language? What do you think of that owner's manual so far, Matt? KC2YDT, K2LIW?
I think it's very good. They really, and they have, pictures to go with, what you're saying. But as far as, the transmit signal, I'm looking at the thing to go. Give you an idea from page 63 all the way to 76 on just enhancing the transmit signal quality.
So just those pages are enhancing the transmit signal. I think you're talking about giving the right equalization to the audio and possibly marrying your voice to that particular microphone, to that rig, so that over the air you sound the best. Is that approximately what's going on here, Matt? Go ahead.
Yeah, affirmative. I did have one friend who is out in Central Islip. He is a really big audio guy. He has, the new, I got the name of radio, Deutsche for 8, really top audio. And he has all the wave meters, et cetera. He's going through with me, basic setting for the parametric EQ, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of information in this one manual. But what's nice about it from what I hear is a lot of the filters that are on this radio, usually you have to pay extra, and it's not on the radio. You gotta get it and put it in.
Matt, your Yaesu 991 covers what radio bands, what frequencies, and roughly how many dollars if I wanted to go out and buy one of those? Go ahead.
It covers 160 through 6 meters and 2 meters and 77 meters as well. Also has the C4FM technology on it as well.
And roughly how many dollars, Matt?
Around 1,700.
And I'm going to guess it runs in the vicinity of 100 watts on many of those HF bands.
Yeah, 100 watts on all HF bands,